Please tell me the reason behind the colors that you fly. Please tell me the reason you want us to unify. You say you're sorry, said there is no other choice. But how can you feel sorry when you kill people with no voice? We can chase down all our enemies, bring them to their knees. We can bomb the world to pieces, but we can't bomb it into peace.
Welcome to Global Community Forum, a show that takes a look behind the scenes at people around the world working for peace, social justice, and the betterment of humankind. I'm Scott Gurian. David Pitordi's brother Jim worked on the 95th floor of World Trade Center Tower 1. He's suspected to have died in the initial impact of the first airplane that hit that building in the terrorist attacks on September 11th. You might be surprised to learn, though, that vengeance is about the last thing on David Pitordi's mind. As the United States has launched a full-fledged military assault on the nation of Afghanistan and embarked upon a war against terrorism that has no indications of ending anytime soon, David has spent the last 6 months traveling across America, speaking out under the theme that his grief is not a cry for war. Along with other relatives of September 11th victims and a busload of nonviolence advocates from around the country, he participated last November in a week-long walk for healing and peace from Washington, D.C. to New York City. Carrying signs reading "No More Victims," peace marchers called on President Bush to seek a nonviolent solution to the conflict in Afghanistan and an end to what they perceive as a cycle of violence. On today's program, we'll hear from David Pitordi about what happened to his brother Jim and what he thinks of America's response to the terrorist attacks. We start with the talk he gave to a group of students at a girls' high school in Jersey City, New Jersey, at one of the stops along the Walk for Healing and Peace.
As I said, I have two brothers. Bill is a little bit older than me, and Jim is my oldest brother, and we lost Jim on September 11th. He worked at the World Trade Center. And in the days that have followed, people have asked me what I'm feeling, what I'm thinking about. And it's interesting that almost right after he passed away, I started thinking about food, because we're Italians, and we like to eat, and we like to cook. And food has just been this very important part of our lives. And when he died, I started thinking about all of these wonderful foods that we grew up eating and enjoying that he would never get to enjoy again. And that was just, it really caught me by surprise. And a year ago, almost at this time, Jim was down at my house. I live in North Carolina now. I used to live in New York. And my whole family was down there. My parents were there. They're still alive. And we were cooking this meal that we cook every Christmas, and it's a Sicilian Christmas Eve dinner, and it's fish-based, and it includes linguine with clam sauce, and oysters that are breaded and fried, and shrimp cocktail, and polenta and bacala, which is this dried salt codfish, and tomato sauce with garlic, and you put it on polenta. And we make this every year. We've done it every year for as long as I can remember. And we eat it, and then a few hours later, we go to church. And we go to midnight mass on Christmas Eve. And I just kept thinking about that meal and realizing that I didn't know that was the last time we'd be making it together, was last year. And here it is almost a year later, and look at how different the world is. And it strikes me that when you kill someone, you're not just killing a person, you're killing their history, and you're killing their heritage and their memories and all those connections you have, you know, through food. You're killing those connections to their parents and their grandparents and their great-grandparents this way, and you're also killing the connections that my brother would have had with my son, who's 17 months old. You know, my brother was his uncle for about a year and a half, and now he has one less uncle. So you're killing all that heritage and all this heritage and all that history. So it's more than just killing a person. You're damaging something that's going to be damaged for many years and many generations. It's going to take place for a long, long time. And I wanted to tell you about a couple people I grew up with that we've started making this new connection with. There was a couple that were in my town. Their names were Jake and Jeanette Geldward, and they were a Jewish couple, and they owned the corner store. It was called Jake's Red and White Store, and it was on the corner from the Immaculate Conception School where I went to school. And that was the store where we bought our bubble gum and our, you know, fudgesicles and our popsicles, and we went there every day. And Jake and Jeanette were in Auschwitz. They were in a concentration camp in World War II. So they had numbers tattooed on their arms. And they were just this wonderful couple that we knew growing up. And they're retired now. They're still alive. My parents are still alive. And they see each other in the supermarket up in Ithaca. They're going shopping, and they bump into each other with their shopping carts. And Jeanette has started talking to my mom about these events. And she said, you know, we know what terrorism is. We experience terrorism. And she kind of comforts her a little bit. And Jeanette was telling her the story of being in Auschwitz. She was in Auschwitz with her whole family, Jeanette was. And she was, I guess, a teenager. And she told my mom the story about being grouped up to go to the gas chamber. And at the last minute, she got pulled out of line. And it was because when she was a girl, she had blonde hair. So somebody took her and said, maybe you shouldn't be in this line. They took her away. And that she had to stand there and watch her mother and her father. And I can't remember if it was sisters or brothers. She had siblings. And they all went in the gas chamber. And she stood there. And she said, to this day, I see that image of my parents going in that door. And I wonder why I didn't go with them. So she carries that with her. This is what, 55, 60 years later? She sees that image every day of her life. And she tells my mom to keep busy and to cook, you know, there's cooking again. And when she gets sad, to go buy some stuff for my son, their new grandson, and to think about life. But the point of telling you that is that these images from war and violence are long-lived. I mean, 60 years later, she sees this image. It's not like you just go drop some bombs and go home. She's carrying that with her every day. And I wanted to tell you about my dad. My dad is 82, and he was a Marine in World War II. And he was in the South Pacific part of the war, so they were hopping on islands. It was Saipan, Tinian, Iwo Jima. You may have heard those names. And they were heading towards Japan. They were going to invade Japan. And my dad has never talked about the war with me ever in his whole life, and I've asked him about it, and he doesn't really want to talk about it. And here's a man who's 82, and I'm a grown-up now, and you would think he would want to, you know, tell me a few war stories, but he just will not tell me. And my mom, again, you know, moms are always sort of the conduit for information in Italian families. My mom told me that one day he was reading this magazine, and it was called Leatherneck Magazine, and it's a magazine specifically for 4th Division Marines who were in this particular section of the war. There's so many of them that they have their own magazine for veterans. And he was reading this magazine, and there was a letter in it from a woman who lost her husband in World War II, and she just, it was an open letter. She said, if anybody knows anything about my husband, write to me, just let me know, because she realized that these veterans were dying off and, you know, they're getting older, and she just wanted whatever information she could get. And my father wrote her a letter. And this is amazing because my father has never written me a letter. You know, he's that generation where, you know, they don't really write letters. He doesn't like talking on the phone. And it turns out that this woman's husband was in the same area with my father. My father did not know him, had never met him, didn't serve directly with him, had never seen his face, but her husband was the first dead body that my father saw in World War II. And he had his name stenciled on the back of his jacket, and he was laying in the water. And my father remembered his name 50 years later. He remembered this man's name. So I think that speaks again to the long-lasting legacies of war. You know, he's been carrying this around with him for 50 years, this man's name. My father lost 75% of his company in combat. So if he can remember this man's name that he never knew, what memories does he have of his friends, three-quarters of his group of guys that he lost in the war, and how they died and how violently they died? And he carries that with him today. And it makes me realize that there's a part of my father that I don't get to enjoy today because he has all that pain inside of him. So my point again, war has long-lasting consequences. It doesn't just involve today. It involves generations, decades of time. There was a history professor from Boston University named Howard Zinn, who I really like, and he's written a lot about American history. And he came to North Carolina 2 weeks ago, and I heard him speak and interviewed him and talked to him. And he's my father's age, and he was in World War II also, but he was in the Air Force. And he talked about bombing cities in Europe in World War II. And he said that he was up so high that he couldn't really see the destruction below when he dropped bombs. And he said, you know, after seeing the World Trade Center destruction, it occurred to me that the cities I was bombing probably looked exactly the same as the World Trade Center. But I was up here, and I didn't see the buildings after I bombed them. And I didn't hear the people screaming. I didn't see people crying because I was up here, and I just flew away. And I wrote a quote that he said. He said, "I was oblivious. I wasn't thinking of the people below as human beings." And he said, "If we learn anything from September 11th, it's that people all over the world are equal to the people at the World Trade Center. We have to expand our compassion to include these people all over the world. When their children die, it's like our children die." So he has also come around to this understanding that we're connected, and he's also carried these memories with him for so many years. So I've been thinking about all of that, and my brother Jim had his picture in the New York Times. I don't know if you see the New York Times, but they've been running pictures of all the victims, every victim, I don't know, however many thousands there are. And so every day they run maybe a dozen faces with a little paragraph about them. And I was thinking how different it would be if everybody who's died in a war, whether in Central America or in Iraq or in Afghanistan right now, if we could see all of their pictures and have a little paragraph about each one, because all of those people are somebody's father, somebody's mother, somebody's sister, brother, aunt, uncle. They all are unique people. They're all individuals. They all have hobbies. Maybe they're really good at telling stories or telling jokes. And there's no difference between them and us, you know. We say us versus them, but there is no us versus them. There's only us, and we're all us. And I think if we could see their pictures, we'd realize that's true, that we are just all part of the same community. And I do feel part of this community. I don't particularly feel like an American right now, and I don't say that to be anti-American or anything like that, but I just feel like I'm part of this community of victims, that I have something in common with people that have suffered in the same way all over the world. And that's not something that has divisions of nationality or race. You know, we're all in this together. You're either down here when the bombs fall, or you're up there. And it doesn't really matter if you're down here who's dropping the bombs, because you're still down here and you're still dying. It doesn't matter whether we're dropping them or Iraq is dropping them or whoever. So I feel a real part of this new community. And I wrote a quote down from Thich Nhat Hanh, the Buddhist monk. And he said this quote, I think it must have been almost 10 years ago, so it wasn't really about the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, but I think it applies. And this is Thich Nhat Hanh. He says, "We cannot divide reality into two camps, the violent and the nonviolent, and stand in one camp while attacking the other. We cannot blame and condemn those we feel are responsible for wars and social injustice without recognizing the violence in ourselves. It is not correct to believe that the world situation is in the hands of the government and that if the president would only have the correct policies, there would be peace. It is our daily lives that have the most to do with war. If we look deeply into the weapons of war, we will see our own minds, our own prejudices, fears, and ignorance. To work for peace is to uproot war from ourselves and from the hearts of men and women. To do this, we must learn to listen in a way that helps us to understand the suffering of others, to see the real losses and the real casualties of war. And just by listening deeply, we can already alleviate a great deal of pain." And he says that is the beginning of healing. So that is Thich Nhat Hanh on war. And it applies very well, I think, to September 11th. And I had another quote here I wanted to read. It's from Margaret Mead, who was an anthropologist. And she said, "Never doubt that a small group of committed people can change the world. Indeed, it is the only thing that ever has." And when you think of September 11th, a small group of committed individuals changed the world. You know, a couple guys with knives got on airplanes and took down buildings, killed my brother, killed thousands of other people, and it was just a small group of people. And I think the challenge facing us in our community, our spiritual community, is can we, as a small group of people, change the world just the way they did, except change it to make the world better, perhaps change our country's foreign policy, and bring people together instead of just going on to kill them.
David Pitordi, whose brother Jim was killed in the World Trade Center on September 11th. He was speaking to a class of high school students last December. If you're just tuning in, this is Global Community Forum, and we're listening to the story of one person whose message is that it's okay to be opposed to war. We move now to an in-depth interview I conducted with David several months ago.
David Pitordi, and I live in Cary, North Carolina, and my brother Jim was working at the World Trade Center and was killed on September 11th.
What are your memories of your brother Jim? What do you think about when you think of him?
Well, it's funny, when your brother dies, it's like a movie. And when I went up to Ithaca, our hometown, shortly after his death, I was just walking around, and everywhere you turn, there was like a flashback. You know how a movie would just go into the sort of the sepia-toned image? And it was like, here's the street where he pushed my go-kart into our neighbor's flower bed. You know, and I haven't thought about that in, what, 30 years or 40 years. And here's where he was pushing me on my bicycle with training wheel. Or it was the first time that I didn't have training wheels on my bicycle, and he was pushing me, and he let me go, and I didn't realize it. And I turned around and realized he wasn't holding me, and I fell over because I realized that he wasn't holding me. You know, those kind of old memories. So I thought a lot about that, and a lot of regrets. You know, he was 52, I'm 45. And it's sort of like the Beatles, you know, you're really close when you're young, and then you sort of all grow up and you go your separate ways. And we were geographically separated for a while. I was on the West Coast and he was in New York, and we sort of fell out of touch and we weren't super close. And then I moved back to the East Coast and had a child, and we were really starting to get back in touch again, you know, the way the kids bring families back together. It sort of gives you an excuse to get back together and send each other presents and make phone calls and send pictures and stuff. He and his wife, or his wife told me after he died that, you know, they really had talked a lot about our son and that they were putting money aside for him in case anything happened to us. And they had really made an agreement that they wanted to see him at least 3 times a year, you know, if not more. And so there's a lot of regret about that, the sense that we were all just kind of getting back together again. And then just as soon as it began to happen, it stopped, you know. So I'm happy for the time we had.
Describe what happened on September 11th, what you remember from that day, how events unfolded.
Oh, it's not hard to remember. Like I said, we have a 17-month-old baby. We have a 17-month-old baby, and when you have a baby, you pretty much start your day with the sound of a baby crying, and either you or your wife gets up. So that morning, that Tuesday morning, it was my turn to sleep in. So I got to sleep in until 8:45. And I was sort of stirring in my bed, and my wife and child noticed that I was getting up. So they came into the bedroom, and they both got in bed with me, which is kind of fun. You know, you got the little baby between you, and you're kind of hanging out. And I was really grumpy, and I hadn't slept well because I had gotten up with him in the middle of the night. And we went in the kitchen. We were having breakfast. I had just finished breakfast. I was holding a cup of coffee and had gone out the back door of our house and was standing on the deck sort of taking some deep breaths and trying to wake up. And the phone rings and the baby starts crying and my wife is trying to hear who's on the phone and she can't. And, you know, it's my mom and she's saying something crazy. And so she hands me the phone and my mom says, I'm really worried about the kamikazes. And I said, what? You know, the World Trade Center. And I said, what? You know, they hit, you know, planes hit the World Trade Center. And I just didn't know what she was talking about. And I came back in and my wife had the TV on and there, you know, there was that image of that tower just burning, you know. And I just remember walking in and seeing that and just my stomach just dropping. And I can't remember, this must have been, I must have seen it live when that second plane hit. I remember just sitting there, what was that, half an hour later or 15 minutes later or
minutes.
Something? Yeah. So I must have turned it on just as the second plane hit, and it was like, what is going on? And I'm sitting on the edge of the couch, and, you know, I'm trying to ask my mom, trying to remind myself, you know, what floor was he on, and which building, you know, which tower was he in? Because I couldn't remember, because he had just started working there 3 years ago. They had moved his office. And she said he was on the 95th floor. And I, you know, I knew the building was 110 stories tall, so I'm sort of mentally counting the stories. And it sure looked like the 95th floor that got hit. And I just remember that feeling like throwing up, being really nauseous, because I realized it wasn't like I could say, oh, he was on the 18th floor. That's, you know, it's nowhere near where that plane was. It was exactly where the plane was. And I just stood there staring at that screen or sitting on the edge of the couch, and we hung the phone up because his wife, Nikki, down in Princeton, was frantic, and she was calling around, and we wanted to keep the phones clear. And the thing I do remember is when the first tower fell and that smoke started shooting horizontally out of the tower, and it looked like an explosion had gone off or something, and the thing just started coming down, and I just remember yelling out loud, like, you know, what, I don't know what I said, but I just realized at that moment that I didn't know where my brother was, but if he was still in that building, there was no chance that he was going to get out. And it was that final when you saw that thing come down. And then when the second one came down, it was just, you know, there's just nothing there. So it was a feeling of literal nausea, of just wanting to throw up. And at the moment, that particular day, we both had the day off, and we were cleaning our garage out because we were trying to fix our garage up and put some windows in and stuff. So we just spent the whole day taking stuff out of our garage and sort of sticking them under the house so we could work in there, and just sort of going back and forth and back and forth in this kind of grunt work, and waiting for the phone to ring, and the phone would ring, and we'd grab it and pick it up, and it would be, you know, one of my wife's students calling. My wife's a teacher, and it would be someone totally unrelated to this, and we'd go, you know, okay, we'd hang it up again. And the whole day, we're just trying to get information, and we didn't hear anything. And we went to bed, and we kind of knew, you know, if we didn't hear anything, that that was not a good sign. And it's hard to remember, but in the immediate aftermath of this attack, there really was nothing coming out of Manhattan. I don't think anybody could call out, couldn't call in. So for like 3 days, we really had hope that he was alive. And we had friends checking hospitals, going door to door in hospitals, and his company was trying to get rosters of people that were at hospitals. And so we would just, you know, go to bed with this sinking feeling every night that, you know, maybe he's somewhere, you know, he has a head injury, he can't say who he is, or they didn't identify him, or he got ferried over to New Jersey, or whatever. And by Friday, we had driven up to Princeton to see Nikki, his wife, and then we drove up to Ithaca to see my folks. And I remember we were eating dinner, and the doorbell rang, and, you know, Mom got up, went to the front door, and there was nobody there, which was very odd. And then the phone rang. Nikki checked in and said, you know, she talked to a couple people from his company, and one of them knew where he was sitting. She got the floor plan of the building, and somebody else was in a building nearby that had actually seen the first plane hit, and it took out 8 floors of the building, and that was one of the floors was his, and that there was just no way that he even survived that initial hit, you know. By the time we knew about it, when we woke up, it was pretty much precisely when I was sitting in bed with my wife and child that morning. That's when he got hit. I herded my family, my mom and dad and my wife, into the living room, and I sat down and just told them, you know, the conversation I had just had. And my mother, you know, it was like I had just hit her in the stomach with a baseball bat. She just bent over, and she just started kind of, it's the sound I have never heard before from her. It was just like coming from just really deep inside of her body, just sort of this husky kind of, I mean, I can't even duplicate it, just sort of a groan coming from really deep inside of her body, series of groans. And she just started, like, saying his name. And she said, it hurts. And she said, I don't want any other family to have to feel the pain that I'm feeling right now. And she didn't qualify that. She didn't say, I don't want any other American family to feel that way. I don't want, you know, she didn't qualify it. So I take that, and I've sort of taken that statement with me from my mom, that I don't want any other family to feel this pain either. So I repeat that statement, and I actually repeated it to a reporter who called us up. The local newspaper called us up, you know, a few days later, and, you know, she was embarrassed, and she didn't want to talk to us and bother us in our grief. And we all kind of said, we don't really want to talk about it. And then I thought, well, you know, why don't I talk about it? Because we have this moment where we can say something. And I called her up, and that's what I said. I said, we should seek justice, but we shouldn't seek justice by bringing pain to other innocent families or something to that effect. And that phrase, they kind of put it in the little sub-headline in the newspaper article, and people just really reacted to it and started, you know, my folks would see people and they'd say something about that statement, and they got cards from anonymous people thanking their other son for saying this. So it really kind of struck a chord with people.
What are your thoughts on all that's taken place since September 11th, specifically, I guess, the push for war and some sort of military response?
Well, immediately, I was just really astonished at how the media completely fell into lockstep just instantly. The framing was the same on all the networks that I saw, and the story was the same, whether it was ABC, NBC, CBS, CNN, whatever. They were all saying exactly the same thing. They were all depicting this the same way. And I remember driving, when I was up in Ithaca, we eventually had a memorial service for him, and I drove my car to Jiffy Lube, you know, because it was a long trip, 700 miles back, and just watching the TV at the Jiffy Lube while you're waiting for the car to get done, and it was CNN was on, and it was America's New War. You know, they had the logo, and it was just, they were just promoting this war, like, you know, yeah. Just overnight, suddenly, we've just got this new product to sell, and everybody was so into it. And I was just, I was very upset. And it was so at odds with what I was experiencing with my family, because they were not crying out for blood, and my dad's a Marine, former Marine, and he was just very taciturn and very quiet, and my mom was very quiet, and my dad's Marine buddies, one of them that was on Iwo Jima with him, came over and brought them communion because he was now an assistant at the Catholic Church, and, you know, and these old vets were just so somber about this whole thing, and they weren't really happy to see war returning. It was like this horrible thing that they had fought and tried to get rid of, and now suddenly here it is coming back. I just got that feeling, you know, this awful monster that they had tried to rid the world of, and here it's swooping back in on us, and I think it made them very sad. So that was reality to me, and then to turn on the TV, and it's like, yeah, new war, let's go kill them, whoever they are. There was such a contrast. And it made me angry. It made me angry that you couldn't hear any opposition anywhere. And I also knew that people were holding vigils and candlelight vigils and prayer services. And I don't know that those were on TV. I don't remember seeing them.
That's David Pitorti, whose brother was killed in the terrorist attacks on September 11th, 2001. If you'd like to obtain a copy of this interview, I'll be giving out our website and contact info at the end of this program, so stay tuned. We'll have more of the interview after this.